years old. He's been at the prison 11 years with a good service record, said Hart. Until today, he did his job. What's your best guess? Is this guard Gary's latest hostage? I asked Wallace. I don't think so. I think the son of a bitch bastard helped Sinigi escape. That same morning, the FBI set up round-the-clock surveillance on Michael Devine and Charles Chakley. One theory was that Sinigi slash Murphy might come after them. He knew that they had screwed up his master plan. The body of prison guard Robert Fischenauer was found in a dilapidated garage on the abandoned farm in Crisfield, Maryland. A $20 bill was stuffed into his mouth. The bill was not part of the Florida ransom money. The usual rumors of Sinigi slash Murphy sightings went on throughout the day. Nothing came of them. Sinigi slash Murphy was out there somewhere, laughing at us, probably howling in some dark cellar. I drove to Jessie's apartment that night around 6. I didn't want to go over there. I had to warn her that Sinigi slash Murphy might have her on his list, especially if he'd connected Jessie with Devine and Chakley. I had to warn Jessie without telling her everything else I knew. I climbed the familiar red brick porch stairs, rang the bell, and Jessie opened the screen door. She was wearing her usual attire, a wrinkled t-shirt, cutoffs, thongs. She smiled and looked glad to see me. My stomach was knotted up tight. The rest of me was very cold. I knew what I had to do now. At least I thought I did. "And one more thing," I said, as if we'd just finished our last conversation a minute ago. Jessie laughed and opened the screen door. I didn't go inside. I stood my ground on the porch. "How about a ride in the country? My treat," I said to Jessie.
"Sounds good to me, Alex. I'll put on some long pants."
A few minutes later, we were on the bike, blasting away from her place.
"We can talk and ride the bike at the same time,"
Jessie turned her head and shouted into the wind. I held on to her back and chest tighter. I shouted against the side of her hair.
"I was worried about you with Sinigi on the loose."
She turned her head.
"Why's that? Why were you worried about me? My Smith & Wesson is at the house."
"Because you helped ruin his perfect crime spree, and maybe he knows that," I wanted to say to her.
"He knows about the two of us from the newspapers," I said to Jessie instead. "He might go after anybody who was involved with the case, especially anybody he thinks helped spoil his little plan."
"Is that the way his mind works, Alex?"
"He wants to show the world how superior he is," I said. "He needs this to be as big and as complicated as the Lindbergh thing was in its day. I believe that's his Lindbergh angle. He wants his crime to be the biggest and the best."
"Who's Bruno Hauptmann in our story? Who is Sinigi trying to set up?"
Jessie called out over the wind.
"Gary Murphy is Bruno Hauptmann," I told her, because I thought I knew the answer. "He's the one Gary Sinigi cleverly framed. He was convicted and went to jail, and he's innocent."
We talked back and forth for the first half hour of the ride. Then it got quiet for mile after mile of open highway.
"What if we go away again?"
I finally asked Jessie the question I'd been working up to. "Go down to the Virgin Islands again. I need it." I wasn't sure if she'd heard me. Then Jessie said,
"All right. I'd like some time with the sun. The islands it is."
I moved in behind her on the speeding motorcycle. The deed was done.
Maggie Rose Dunn wanted to live more than anything else. She understood that now. She wanted her life to return to the way it had been. She wanted to see her mother and father so much, to see all of her friends, her Washington and Los Angeles friends, but especially Michael. What had happened to Shrimpy Goldberg? Had they let him go? Had he been ransomed, but for some reason she hadn't? Maggie worked picking vegetables every day, and the work was hard, but most of all, the work was the most boring thing she could ever imagine doing. She had to put her mind somewhere else during the long days under the burning sun. She just had to get her mind off what she was doing and where she was. Nearly a year and a half after the kidnapping, Maggie Rose Dunn escaped from where they were hiding her. She had disciplined herself to wake up early every morning, before any of the others. She did this for weeks before she tried anything. It was still dark outside, but she knew the sun would start to rise in almost an hour. Then it would be so hot. She went into the kitchen in her bare feet, holding her work shoes in her hand. If they caught her now, she could say she was only going to the bathroom. Her bladder was full, a precaution she'd taken in case she was caught. They told her that she would never escape, not even if she got out of that particular village. It was over 50 miles to another town, in any direction she chose, so they told her. The mountains were full of snakes and dangerous cats. Sometimes she heard the cats growl at night. She would never make it to another town. They told her that. And if they did catch her, they would put her under the ground for at least a year. Did she remember what it was like being buried? The kitchen door was locked. She had learned where the key was kept, with a lot of other rusty old keys in a tool closet. Maggie Rose took the key and also a small hammer to use as a weapon. She slid the hammer under the elastic of her shorts. Maggie used the key for the kitchen door. It opened, and she was outside. For the first time in so long, she was free. Her heart soared like the hawks she sometimes saw flying high over the hiding place. Just the act of walking by herself felt so good. Maggie Rose walked for several miles. She had decided to go downhill rather than up the mountains, even though one of the children swore there was a town not far in that direction. She had taken two hard rolls from the kitchen, and she snacked on them through the early morning. It started to get warm as the sun rose. By 10 o'clock, it was quite hot. She had been following a dirt road for miles, not walking in the road, but staying close enough. She always kept the road in sight. She walked on through the long afternoon, amazed that her strength held up in the heat. Maybe all the hard work in the fields had paid off. She was stronger now than she had ever been. She had muscles everywhere. Late in the afternoon, Maggie Rose could see the town as she continued down the mountainside. It was bigger and more modern than where she had been kept for so many months. Maggie Rose started to run down the final hills. The dirt road finally intersected with a concrete one, a real road. Maggie followed the road a short distance, and then there was a gas station. It was an ordinary gas station. Shell, the sign said. She'd never seen anything more beautiful in her life. Maggie Rose looked up, and the man was there. He asked her if she felt all right. He always called her Bobby, and she knew that the man cared about her a little. Maggie told him that she was fine. She had just been lost in a thought.
The trip to Virgin Gorda began in Washington, D.C. on a bleak, rainy Friday morning. It was about 50 degrees. Under normal circumstances, I couldn't have gotten out of there fast enough. We had to change to a 3-engine Trilander in sun-drenched Puerto Rico. By 3:30 in the afternoon, Jesse and I were gliding down toward a white sandy beach, a narrow landing strip bordered by tall palms swaying in the sea breeze. "There it is," she said from the seat beside me. "There's our place in the sun, Alex. I could stay here for about a month."
"It does look like what the doctor ordered," I had to agree.
"This weary traveler wants to be in that water, not looking down at it," Jesse said. "Exist on fish and fruit, swim till we drop." As the door of the Trilander opened, the fragrant smells of the Caribbean breezed in. Warm air rushed over the nine of us inside the small plane. Everybody was decked out in sunglasses and brightly colored T-shirts. Smiles broke out on nearly every face. I forced a smile, too. Jesse took my hand. Black men and women with British accents took us through a sort of relaxed mini-customs. Neither Jesse's nor my bags were searched. This had actually been prearranged with the help of the U.S. State Department. Inside my bag was a small-caliber revolver, loaded and ready.
"Alex, I still love it here," Jesse said as we approached the tiny queue for taxis.
Along with the cabs were a number of scooters, bicycles, dirty minivans. I wondered if we'd ever take another motorcycle ride together again.
"Let's stay here forever," she said. "Pretend we never have to leave. No more clocks, no radios, no news."
"I like the sound of that," I told her. "We'll play Let's Pretend for a while."
"You're on. Let's do it."
Cruise ships and sailboats were collecting out on the sparkling sea. We passed small restaurants and shops for snorkeling gear.
The brightly painted one-story homes all had TV antennas sticking from their rooftops. Our place in the sun. Paradise.
Jesse and I had time to catch a swim at the hotel. We showed off a little. We stretched our bodies, racing out and back to a distant reef. Afterward, we sprawled on the beach. We watched the sun drop down onto the horizon, bleed into it, then disappear from sight.
Deja vu, Alex. Jesse smiled. Just like before. Or did I dream that?
It's different now, I said, then quickly added, we didn't know each other so well before.
What was Jesse really thinking?
I knew that she must have a plan now, too. I figured she knew I was on to Divine and Shakely. She needed to know what I planned to do about them. A young black stud, muscular and trim in his white bathing suit and crisp hotel T-shirt, carried piña coladas down to our beach chairs. The slow-down pace of the island took over eventually. We had dinner at the hotel's pavilion restaurant. Sitting there in the perfect Caribbean surroundings, I believe that I felt more duplicitous and completely unreal than I had in my entire life. I watched the grilled pompano and grouper and turtle come and go. I listened to the reggae band get ready. And all the while, I was thinking that this beautiful woman beside me had let Michael Goldberg die. I was also certain that she had murdered Maggie Rose Dunn, or at least been an accomplice. She'd never shown a hint of remorse. Somewhere back in the States was her share of the $10 million ransom, but Jesse was smart enough to let me split the trip expenses with her. She ate island lobster and an appetizer plate of shark bites. She drank two ales at dinner. Jesse was so smooth and smart. What do you talk about to a murderer and someone you loved over a perfect dinner and cocktails? I wanted to know so many things, but I couldn't ask any of the real questions pounding in my head.
All right, Alex, she finally said. Do you want to tell me what we're really doing on Virgin Gorda? Is there another agenda working here?
I had prepared myself for the question, but it still took me by surprise. She had fired it in beautifully. I was ready to lie. I wanted us to be able to talk, to really talk to each other. Maybe for the first time, Jesse. Tears started in the corner of Jesse's eyes. They slowly ran down her cheeks.
I love you, Alex, Jesse whispered. It's just that it will always be so hard for the two of us.
Are you saying the world isn't ready for us? I asked her. Or aren't we ready for the world?
I don't know which of those is right. Does it matter that it's just so hard?
We walked along the beach after dinner, down toward a shipwrecked galleon. The picturesque wreck was stranded about a quarter of a mile from the main pavilion and restaurant. The beach appeared to be deserted. There was some moonlight, but it got darker as we approached the fallen ship. Finally, Jesse was little more than a dark shape beside me. Everything about the moment made me extremely uncomfortable. I had left my gun in the room.
Alex.
Jesse had stopped walking. At first I thought she'd heard something, and I looked over my shoulder. I knew Suniji / Murphy couldn't be down here. Was it possible I could be wrong?
I was wondering, Jesse said, thinking about something from the investigation, and I don't want to. Not down here.
What's bothering you? I asked her.
You stopped talking to me about the investigation. How did you wind up with Chickley and Divine?
Well, since you brought the subject up, I said to her, I'll tell you. You were right all the time about the two of them. Another stone-cold dead end. Now, let's have a real vacation. We've both earned it.
Gary Suniji / Murphy watched. First, there was the pair of FBI Goonigans in a black Buick Skylark, a male and a female Goonie, to be precise, who were on stakeout duty. They were certainly harmless enough, no problem for him there. Next, there was the modern high-rise building where Agent Mike Devine still lived in Washington, the Hawthorne, it was called. Rooftop pool and sun deck, garage parking, concierge service around the clock. Very nice digs for the ex-agent. And the FBI goons were watching the building as if it might sprout wings and fly away. A few minutes past 10 o'clock that morning, a Federal Express delivery man entered the Shishi apartment building. Moments later, Dressed in the Federal Express uniform and carrying actual packages for two tenants in the Hawthorne, Gary Sanigi / Murphy pushed the buzzer for 17J. Avon calling. When Mike Devine opened the door, Sanigi sprayed him with the same strong chloroform potion he'd used on Michael Goldberg and Maggie Rose Dunn. Just like the two children, Devine crumpled onto the wall-to-wall carpeting in his foyer. Agent Devine woke up after several minutes. He was woozy and had double vision. All of his clothes had been stripped off. He was totally confused and disoriented. He was propped up in the bathtub with cold water halfway to the rim. His ankles were handcuffed to the faucet handles.
"What the fuck is this?"
His first words came out slurred and sloppy. "This is an extremely sharp knife," Gary Sanigi / Murphy bent over and showed off his Bowie hunting knife. "Watch this graphic demonstration. Focus those big, blurry blue eyes of yours now. Focus, Michael." Sanigi barely nicked the former agent's upper arm with the knife. Devine cried out. A dangerous-looking 3-inch cut opened up instantly. Blood flowed into the cold, swirling bathwater. "Not another peep," Sanigi warned. He brandished the knife, threatening Devine with another nick. "This isn't exactly the sensor razor from Gillette."
"Who are you?"
Devine attempted to speak again. He was still slurring badly. "I'm Gary Sanigi / Murphy. Excuse the tacky delivery boy uniform, the rather crude disguise, but I'm in sort of a hurry, don't you know? It's a pity, because I've been wanting to meet you for months, you rascal, you."
"What the hell do you want?"
Devine struggled to maintain some of his authority. "Cut to the chase. Okay, good. You have two very clear choices. One, I'll have to cut off your penis here and now, put it in your mouth as a convenient gag, and then torture you with little flesh cuts, hundreds of cuts, starting with the face and neck, until you tell me what I need to know. All right so far?" Devine's head involuntarily leaned back away from the looming madman. His vision was clearing, unfortunately. His eyes, in fact, were wide open. "Second option," the madman continued to rant in his face, "I am going to get the truth from you right now. Then I'll go get my money, wherever you've stashed it. I'll come back and kill you, but nicely. No theatrics. Who knows? You might even manage to escape while I'm gone. That's doubtful, but hope springs eternal. I have to tell you, Michael, that's the option I'd choose." Mike Devine was clear-headed enough to make the correct choice, too. He told Sanigi / Murphy where his share of the ransom money was. It was right there in Washington. Gary Sanigi / Murphy believed him, but then, who could really tell about these things? Gary paused at the apartment door on his way out. In his best Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator voice, he said, "I'll be back." Actually, he was feeling exceptionally good about things today.
I slept restlessly, waking just about every hour on the hour. There was no piano to go pound out on the porch, no Janny and Damon to go wake, only the murderer peacefully sleeping at my side, only the plan I was there to execute. When the sun finally rose, the hotel kitchen staff fixed us a fancy box lunch to go. They packed a wicker basket with fine wines, French bottled water, expensive gourmet goodies. There was also snorkeling gear, fluffy towels, a striped yellow and white beach umbrella. Everything was already loaded onto a speedboat when we arrived on the dock at just past 8. It took the boat about 30 minutes to get to our island, a beautiful secluded spot, paradise regained. We would be out there alone all day. Other couples from the hotel had their own private islands to visit. The water was the clearest bottle green. When I looked straight down, I could see the texture of the sand on the bottom. A smiling pair of 5-foot-long barracuda had followed our boat almost to the shoreline, then lost interest. "What time would you like me to come back?" the boat driver asked. He was a muscular fisherman, a sailor in his 40s. "Oh, I think 2 or 3 o'clock." I looked for some help from Jesse. "What time should Mr. Richards come back for us?"
She was busy laying out beach towels and the rest of our exotic gear.
I think 3 is good. That sounds great, Mr. Richards.
All right, then. Have fun, you two. You're all alone. I can see my services are no longer required.
Mr. Richards saluted us, then hopped back into the boat. He started the engine and soon had vanished from sight. We were all alone on our private island. There was something so strange and unreal about lying on a beach towel next to a kidnapper and murderer. I went over and over all of my feelings, plans, the things I knew I had to do. I tried to get control of my confusion and rage. I had loved this woman who was now such a stranger. I closed my eyes and let the sun relax my muscles. Gary Sinise flew out of nowhere. He came suddenly and with no warning. He had a foot-long hunting knife like the one he'd used in the D.C. ghetto killings. He was arched high overhead, his shadow covering me completely. There was no way he could have gotten onto the island. No way.
Alex! Alex, you were dreaming!
Jessie said. She put a cool hand on my shoulder. She gently touched my cheek with the tips of her fingers. The long, mostly sleepless night, the warm sun and the cooling sea breeze, I had fallen asleep on the beach. I looked up at Jessie. She had been the shadow over my body, not Sinise.
How long was I out? I asked.
Phew!
Just a couple of minutes, baby, she said. Alex, let me hold you. Jessie moved against me on the beach towel. Her breasts brushed my chest. She had taken off her bathing suit top while I slept. Her smooth skin glowed with tanning oil. I sat up and moved away from Jessie on the towel. I pointed to where a garden of bougainvillea grew, almost to the seawater.
Let's walk down along the beach, okay? Let's take a walk. I want to talk to you about a few things.
What kinds of things?
Jessie asked me.
She was clearly disappointed that I was putting her off. She'd wanted to make love on the beach. I didn't.
Come on, let's walk and talk a little, I said. The sun feels so good.
I pulled Jessie up and she came along with me somewhat reluctantly. She didn't bother to put her top back on. We walked along the shoreline with our feet in the clear, calm water. We weren't touching now, but we were only inches apart. It was so strange and unreal. It was one of the worst moments of my life, if not the worst.
You're being so serious, Alex. We were going to have fun, remember? Are we having fun yet?
I know what you did, Jessie. It's taken a while, but I finally pulled it together, I told her. I know that you took Maggie Rose Dunn from Sinise. I know that you killed her. I want to talk about all of it. I don't have a wire on me, Jessie. Obviously. She half-smiled at that. Always the perfect actress.
I can see you don't, she said.
My heart was booming at a tremendous rate. Tell me what happened. Just tell me why, Jessie.
Tell me what I spent almost 2 years trying to find out, and you knew all the time.
Tell me your side of this.
Jessie sounded resigned.
All right, Alex. I'll tell you some of what you want to know. What you just wouldn't leave alone.
We continued to walk, and Jessie finally told me the truth.
How did it happen? Well, in the beginning we were just doing our job. I swear that's true. We were babysitting the secretary's family. Gerald Goldberg wasn't used to getting threats. The Colombians made a threat against him. He acted like the civilian that he is. He overreacted. He demanded Secret Service protection for his entire family. That's how it all began, with a surveillance detail that none of us thought was necessary.
So you assigned 2 lightweight agents, I said.
2 friends, actually. Not lightweights at all. We figured the detail would be a boondoggle. Then Mike Devine noticed that one of the teachers, a math teacher named Gary Sinise, had made a couple of passes by the Goldberg house. At first we thought he had a crush on the boy. Devine and Chickley thought he might be a pederast. Nothing more than that. We had to check him out anyway. It was in the original logs that Devine and Chickley kept.
One of them followed Gary Sinise? I asked.
A couple of times, yes. To a couple of places. We weren't really concerned at that point, but we were following through. One night, Charlie Chickley tailed him into Southeast. We didn't connect Shinichi to the murders there, especially since the story never made any splash in the papers. Just more inner-city murders, you know?
Yeah, I do know. When did you suspect something else about Gary Shinichi?
We didn't suspect a kidnapping until he actually picked up the two kids. 2 days before that, Charlie Shakely had followed him out to the farm in Maryland. Charlie didn't suspect a kidnapping at the time. No reason to. But he knew where the farm was located now. Mike Devine called me from the school when it all came crashing down. They wanted to go after Shinichi then. That's when it struck me about taking the ransom ourselves. I don't know for sure. Maybe I thought of it before. It was so easy, Alex. 3 or 4 days and it would be over. Nobody would be hurt. Not any more than they'd already been hurt. We'd have the ransom money. Millions.
The way Jessie spoke about the kidnapping plot so casually was scary. She downplayed it, but it had been her idea. Not Devine's or Chakley's idea. Jessie's. She was the mastermind.
What about the children? I asked. What about Maggie Rose and Michael? They'd already been kidnapped. We couldn't stop what had already happened. We staked out the farm in Maryland. We were confident that nothing could happen to the kids. He was a math teacher. We didn't think he'd hurt them. We thought he was nothing but an amateur. We were completely in control.
He buried them in a box, Jessie, and Michael Goldberg died. Jessie stared out to sea. She nodded slowly.
Yes, the little boy died. That changed everything, Alex. Forever. I don't know if we could have prevented it. We moved in and took Maggie Rose then. We made our own kidnap demands. The whole plan changed.
The two of us continued to walk along the edge of the shimmering water. Jessie finally looked at me.
I want to tell you how it was between us, Alex. My side of things. It's not what you think.
I had no words for her.
When it started, down in Florida, I needed to know whatever you could find out. I wanted a connection inside the D.C. police. You were supposed to be a good cop. You were also your own man.
So you used me to watch your flanks. You chose me to hand over the ransom. You couldn't trust the Bureau. Always the professional, Jessie.
I knew you wouldn't do anything to endanger the little girl. I knew you'd deliver the ransom. The complications started after we got back from Miami. I don't know exactly when. I swear this is the truth.
I felt numb and hollow inside as I listened to her.
For what it's worth now, I fell in love with you, Alex. I did. You were so many of the things I'd given up looking for. Warm and decent, loving, understanding. Damon and Janelle touched me. When I was with you, I felt whole again.
I was a little dizzy and nauseated. For what it's worth, I fell in love with you too, Jessie. I tried not to, but I did.
I just couldn't have imagined anybody lying to me the way you did. Lying and deceiving. I still can't believe all the lies.
What about Mike Devine? I asked. Jessie shrugged her shoulders. That was her only answer.
You committed the perfect crime. A masterpiece, I told her then. You created the master crime that Gary Shinichi always wanted to commit.
Jessie peered into my eyes. There was just one more piece to the puzzle. One last thing that I had to know. One unthinkable detail.
What really happened to the little girl? What did you or Devine and Shakely do with Maggie Rose?
Jessie shook her head.
No, Alex. That I can't tell you. You know that I can't.
How could you kill a little girl? How could you do it, Jessie? How could you kill Maggie Rose Dunn?
Jessie suddenly whirled away from me. It was too much, even for her.
She headed back toward the beach umbrella and towels. I took a quick step, and I caught her arm. I grabbed the crook of her elbow.
Get your hands off me, she screamed.
Maybe you can trade me the information about Maggie Rose, I shouted back. Maybe we can make a trade, Jessie. She turned around.
They're not going to let you open this case again. Don't kid yourself, Alex. They don't have a thing on me. Neither do you. I'm not going to trade you information.
Yeah. Yeah, you are, I said. I pointed up toward the barranca and the palm trees that thickened as you got farther from the sandy beach. Samson stood up from his hiding spot in the deep island brush. He waved something that looked like a silver wand. What he was actually holding was a long-distance microphone. Two FBI agents got up and waved, too. They stood beside Samson. They'd all been out in the bush since before 7 that morning. The agents were as red as lobsters around the face and arms. Samson probably had the tan of his life also. "My friend Samson up there? He's recorded everything you said since we started our walk." Jesse closed her eyes for several seconds. "You'll tell us now how you murdered Maggie Rose," I demanded. Jesse moved to hit me, but I blocked her fist with a forearm. Her body twisted and she went down. "That's a start, Alex," she said from her sandy seat on the beach. "You're becoming a bastard, too. Congratulations." "Nah," I said to Jesse. "I'm just fine. There's nothing wrong with me." I let the FBI agents and Samson make the formal arrest of Jesse Flanagan. Then I took a skiff back to the hotel. I packed and was on my way back to Washington within the hour. 2 days after we returned to D.C., Samson and I were back on the road. We were headed for Uyuni, Bolivia. We had reason to hope and believe that we might have finally found Maggie Rose Dunn. Jesse had traded information. She had refused to talk to the Bureau, though. She traded with me. Uyuni is in the Andes Mountains, 191 miles south of Oruro. The way to get there is to land a small plane in Rafal Malato, then go by jeep or van to Uyuni. A Ford Explorer held 8 of us for the final leg of the difficult trip. I was in the minivan with Samson, 2 special agents from Treasury, the U.S. ambassador to Bolivia, our driver, and Thomas and Catherine Rose Dunn. Charles Chickling and Jesse had both been willing to trade information about Maggie Rose during the last grueling 36 hours. The butchered body of Mike Devine had been found in his Washington apartment. The manhunt for Gary Sinigi / Murphy had intensified after the body was discovered, but so far, nothing. Chakley and Jesse told virtually the same tale about the kidnapping. There had been an opportunity to take the $10 million ransom and get away with it. They couldn't return the girl. They needed us to believe that Sinigi / Murphy was the kidnapper. The girl could dispute that. They'd drawn the line at killing Maggie Rose, though. I watched the Dunns as we approached Uyuni. They sat together quietly, a little distant from each other. As Catherine had told me, losing Maggie Rose had nearly destroyed their marriage. I was reminded of how much I'd liked them in the beginning. I liked Catherine Rose. We had talked for a while during the trip. She thanked me with genuine emotion, and I would never forget that. I hoped the little girl was waiting safely at the end of this long and horrible ordeal. I thought about Maggie Rose Dunn, a little girl I had never met and was about to meet soon. Samson elbowed me as we drove through the village.
"Look up the hill there, Alex. I won't say this makes it all worthwhile, but maybe it comes close."
The minivan was climbing a steep hill in the village of Uyuni. Tin and wood shacks lined both sides of what was virtually an alleyway cut into rock. Smoke spiraled from a couple of tin rooftops. The narrow lane seemed to continue straight up into the Andes Mountains. Maggie Rose was there waiting for us halfway up the road. The 11-year-old girl stood in front of one of the nearly identical shacks. She was with several other members of a family called Patino. She had been with them for nearly 2 years. It looked as if there were a dozen other children in the family. From 100 yards away, as the van strained up the rutted dirt road, we could all see her clearly. Maggie Rose wore the same kind of loose shirt, cotton shorts, and thongs as the other Patino children, but her blonde hair made her stand out. She was tan. She appeared to be in good health. She looked just like her beautiful mother. The Patino family had no idea who she really was. They had never heard of Maggie Rose Dunn in Uyuni, or in nearby Pulacayo, or in Ubina, 11 miles over the high and mighty Andes Mountains. We knew that much from the Bolivian officials and police. The Patino family had been paid for keeping the girl in the village, keeping her safe, but keeping her there. Maggie had been told by Mike Devine that there was nowhere for her to escape to. If she tried, she would be caught and she would be tortured. I couldn't take my eyes off her now. This little girl, who had come to mean so much to so many people, I couldn't believe she was really standing there, after all this time. Maggie Rose didn't smile or react in any way. as she watched us coming up the hill in the U.S. Embassy van. She didn't seem happy that someone had finally come for her, that she was being rescued. She appeared very confused, wounded, and afraid. I wondered if Maggie Rose knew what was happening. She had been severely traumatized. I wondered if she could feel anything at all. Catherine Rose was the first one out of the minivan. At that very moment, Maggie Rose opened her arms. "Mommy!" she cried out. Then Maggie Rose ran toward her mother. They ran into each other's arms. For the next minute, I couldn't see much of anything through my tears. I looked at Samson and saw a tear seeping from under his dark glasses. "Two tough detectives," he said and grinned at me. Maggie Rose was finally going home. It was worth everything just to see that moment. "The end," Samson pronounced.
The Cross House was right there across the street. The bad boy was mesmerized by the glittering orangish house lights. His eyes roamed from window to window. A couple of times he caught sight of a black woman shuffling past one of the windows downstairs. He crossed Fifth Street and disappeared into the bushes that ran alongside the front of the house. He turned so that he faced away from the house. He could actually feel warmth from the walls on his back. He was careful. He took his sweet time. He watched the street for 10 minutes or more. No one had seen him. No one was spying on him this time. One last touch, and then on to other bigger and better things. Each detail had been thought through hundreds of times before this particular night. Once they were all sound asleep, probably between 2 and 3 in the morning, he would take the two children, Damon and Janelle. He would drug them, right there in their bedroom on the second floor. He would let Dr./Detective Alex Cross sleep through everything. He had to do that. The famous Dr. Cross needed to suffer a great deal now. Cross had to be part of the new search. That was the way it had to be. Not that Cross would need any extra motivation, but he'd get it anyway. First, the bad boy would murder the old woman, Cross's grandmother. Then he would go to the children's bedroom. None of it would ever be solved, of course. The Cross children would never ever be found. No ransom would be asked for. Then, finally, he could go on to other things. He'd forget about Detective Cross. But Alex Cross would never, ever forget about him. Or about his own missing children. Gary Sinigi/Murphy turned toward the house.
"Alex, there's someone inside the house. Alex, someone's in here with us," Nana whispered close to my ear. I was up and out of bed before she finished speaking the words. I heard the softest thump somewhere. Yes, someone was definitely in the house. "Nana, you stay here. Don't come out until I call you," I whispered to my grandmother. "I'll yell when it's okay."
"I'll call the police, Alex."
"No, you stay right here. I am the police. Stay here."
"The children, Alex?"
"I'll get them. You stay here. I'll bring the children. Please obey me this one time." There was no one in the darkened hallway upstairs. No one I could see anyway. My heart raced uncontrollably as I hurried to the children's room. I listened for another sound in the house. It was too still now. I knew who it was. I kept my guard up for weeks after Samson and I had returned with Maggie Rose. Finally, I'd let it down just a little, and he'd come. I hurried to the children's room. I started to run down the upstairs hallway. I opened the creaking door. Damon and Janelle were still asleep in their beds. I would wake them quickly, then carry them both back to Nana. I never kept my gun upstairs because of the children. It was downstairs in the den. I switched on the lamp beside the bed. Nothing. The light didn't come on. I remembered the Sanders and Turner murders. Sinigi had loved darkness. He had always turned the electricity off. Suddenly, I was struck very hard with terrifying force. Something had hit me like a speeding runaway truck. I knew it was Shinichi. He came again. We went down with a loud crash. The air was crushed from my stomach. The side of my head struck a sharp edge of the children's bureau. My vision was clouded. My ears rang.
Dr. Cross, is that you? Did you forget whose show this is?
I could barely see Gary Shinichi's face when he screamed out my name.
You can't touch me! You can't touch me, Doctor! Do you get it? I'm the star, not you!
Blood was smeared all over his hands and arms. Blood was everywhere. My blood. He'd stabbed me when he hit me the first time. He raised the knife to strike a second time and growled like an animal. The children were awake now. Damon screamed, "Daddy!" And Janny started to cry. "Get out of here, kids!" I shouted, but they were too terrified to leave their beds. He fainted with the knife once. Then the blade slashed at me again. I moved, and the knife cut a blow across my shoulder. I yelled loudly at Shinichi / Murphy. The children were crying. I wanted to kill him now. Shinichi / Murphy raised his knife again. The lethal blade was long and so sharp I hadn't even felt the first wound. It had cut right through. I heard another scream, a fierce shriek. Shinichi stood frozen for the eeriest split second. Then he whirled around with another growl. A figure came sweeping at him from the doorway. Nana Mama had distracted him. "This is our house," she shouted with all her fury. "Get out of our house." A glint of light caught my eye on the bureau. I reached out and grabbed the scissors on top of Janny's book of paper dolls, a pair of Nana's shearing scissors. I swung the scissors at him and felt tearing flesh. The shearing scissors slashed down across his cheeks. His cry echoed through the bedroom.
"Motherfucker!"
He rushed at me. The scissors caught him somewhere on the side of his neck. He jumped back, pulling them right from my hand. "Come on, you bastard," I yelled. Suddenly, he reeled and staggered out of the children's bedroom. He never struck out at Nana, the mother figure. Maybe he was too badly wounded to strike back. He held his face in both hands. His voice rose in a high, piercing scream as he ran from the room. I had gone down on one knee and wanted to stay there. The noise was a loud roar in my head. I managed to get up. Blood was splattered everywhere, on my shirt, all over my shorts, my bare legs. My blood and his. A rush of adrenaline kept me going. I grabbed some clothes and went after Shinichi. He couldn't escape this time. I ran to the den and grabbed my revolver. I knew he had a plan, in case he had to escape. Every step would have been thought through 100 times. The front door was wide open. Blood was smeared all over the carpet. Had he left a trail for me? Where would Gary Shinichi / Murphy go if something went wrong at our house? He would always have a backup plan. Where was the perfect place? The completely unexpected move? I was finding it hard to think with blood dripping from my side and left shoulder. I reeled outside and into the early morning darkness and biting cold. It was 4 a.m. I had only one idea where he might have gone. I wondered if he thought I'd try to follow him. Was he already expecting me? The Metro Underground ran a block from our house on 5th Street. The tunnel was still being built, but a few neighborhood kids went down there to walk the 4 blocks over to Capitol Hill, underground. I hobbled and half ran to the subway entrance. I went downstairs into the tunnel. I drew my revolver from the shoulder holster I'd slung over my shirt. Every step I took put a ragged stitch in my side. Painfully, I began to walk the length of the tunnel in a low shooter crouch. He could be watching me. Had he expected me to come here? I walked forward in the tunnel. It could be a trap. There were plenty of places for him to hide. I made it all the way to the end. There was no sign of blood anywhere. Shinichi / Murphy wasn't in the underground. He'd escaped some other way. He'd gotten away again. As the adrenaline rush slowed, I felt weak and weary and disoriented. I climbed the stone stairs out of the underground. Night people were coming and going from the Metro Paper Store and from Fox's all-night diner. I must have been a sorry sight. Blood was splattered all over me. No one stopped, though. They had all seen too much of this ghoulish stuff in the nation's capital. I finally stepped in front of a truck driver, dropping off a bundle of Washington Posts. I told him I was a police officer. I made him take me home in his paper delivery truck. Squad cars and EMS ambulances were already gathered at my house. Samson was already there. He looked at me as if I were crazy. Crimson and blue emergency lights twirled behind him.
"What's up? You don't look so good. You all right, man?"
"Been stabbed twice with a hunting knife. Not as bad as the time he got shot over in Garfield."
"Uh-huh. Must look worse than it is. I want you to lie down here on the lawn. Lie down now, Alex."
I nodded and walked away from Samson. I had to finish this. The EMS people were trying to get me down on the lawn, or get me on their stretcher. I had another idea. The front door had been left wide open. He'd left the door to the house open. Why had he done that?
"Be right with you," I said to the medics as I walked past them. "Hold that stretcher, though."
People were yelling at me, but I pushed forward anyway. I moved silently and purposefully through the living room and into the kitchen. I opened the door that's catty-cornered to our back door and hurried downstairs. I didn't see anything in the basement. No movement, nothing out of order. The cellar was my last good idea. I walked over to a bin near the furnace where Nana dumps all the dirty laundry for the next wash load. It's the farthest corner of the basement from the stairs. No Suniji slash Murphy in the dark basement. Samson came running down the cellar stairs.
"He's not here. Someone saw him downtown. He's down around DuPont Circle."
"He wants to make one more big play," I muttered. "Son of a bitch. Son of Lindbergh." Samson didn't try to stop me from going with him. He could see in my eyes that he couldn't anyway. The two of us hurried to his car. It took us 10 minutes or so to get down to DuPont Circle. Police squad cars were parked everywhere. It was late in the night shift for most of these boys. Nobody needed a madman on the loose in downtown Washington. During the next hour or so, nothing happened, except that it got light out. Pedestrians began to appear around the circle. The traffic thickened as Washington opened up for business. An EMS doctor treated my wounds. There was more blood than actual damage. He wanted me to go straight to the hospital, of course. That could wait. I told the EMS doctor back off, and he did. I hit him up for a couple of Percodan. They did the trick for the moment. Samson stood by my side.
"You're gonna just fall over," he said to me. "You'll just collapse, like some big African elephant who had a sudden heart attack."
I eventually started to walk back towards Samson's car.
"You got an idea?" he called after me. "Alex."
"Yeah. Let's ride. No good standing around here at DuPont Circle. He's not going to start shooting up rush hour traffic." We rode around downtown Washington until just before 8. It was getting hopeless. I was starting to get real sleepy in the car. A call came over the car radio at 7:58.
"Suspect spotted on Pennsylvania Avenue near Lafayette Park. Suspect has an automatic weapon in his possession. Suspect is approaching the White House. All cars move in."
One more big play. At least I finally had him figured out a little. He was less than 2 blocks from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue when they found him. That was 2 blocks from the White House. They had him pinned down between a shoe repair shop and a brownstone building full of law offices. He was using a parked Jeep Cherokee for cover. There was another complication. He had hostages. He'd taken 2 young kids who'd been on their way to school early that morning. The children looked to be 11 or 12. There was a boy and a girl.
"I'm Divisional Chief Cross," I said, and got through the police barricades that were already set up across Pennsylvania Avenue.
The White House was clearly visible down the street. I wondered if the president was watching us on TV. At least one CNN news truck was already on the scene. A couple of news station helicopters moved in overhead. This was restricted airspace near the White House, so they couldn't get too close. Somebody said Mayor Monroe was on his way. Gary had bigger prey in mind. He had demanded to see the president. Otherwise, he'd kill the 2 children. Traffic on Pennsylvania Avenue and the intersecting streets was already backed up as far as I could see. I talked to the police SWAT team leader behind the barricades. I told him I thought Gary Suniji slash Murphy was ready to go down in flames. He offered to light the match. A negotiator was already at the scene. He was more than willing to hand over the honor to me. I was finally going to negotiate a settlement with Suniji slash Murphy.
"We get the chance," Samson grabbed me and spoke very directly,
We're going to pop him. Nothing tricky, Alex.
Tell that to him, I said to Samson. But if you get the chance, hit him. I had an electric bullhorn, and I flicked the power on.
This is Alex Cross, I called out.
A burst of wild gunfire suddenly erupted across the street. Loud noise. Car windows blew out all over Pennsylvania Avenue. It did an amazing amount of damage in just a few seconds. Nobody was hurt that I could see. The two children were unharmed. Then a voice came from across the street. Gary's voice. He was shouting at me. It was just the two of us. Was that what he wanted? His own high noon in the middle of the Capitol. Live national TV coverage.
Let me see you, Dr. Cross. Come on out, Alex.
Why should I?
I spoke over the bullhorn to Suniji. There was another explosion of gunfire from across the avenue. This one went on even longer than the first burst. I stood up suddenly and came out from behind a police sedan. Not too far, just enough to get killed.
The TV stations are here, Gary, I shouted. They're filming this now. They're filming me as I stand here. I'm going to wind up as the big star.
Suniji slash Murphy started to laugh. His laughter went on for a while. Was he manic? Depressive?
You finally got me figured out. Have you? Do you know who I am now? Do you know what I want?
I doubt it. I know that you're hurt. I know that you think you're dying. Otherwise,
I stopped to make this sound as dramatic as it would be to him.
Otherwise, you wouldn't have let us catch you again.
Directly across Pennsylvania Avenue, Suniji slash Murphy stood up behind the bright red Jeep. Both children lay on the sidewalk behind him. Neither seemed to be hurt so far. Gary took a theatrical bow in my direction. He looked like the all-American boy, just as he did in court. I was walking toward him now, getting closer and closer.
Nice touch! Well said! But I'm the star!
He suddenly shifted his gun in my direction. A shot rang out behind me. Gary Suniji slash Murphy flew back in the direction of the shoe repair shop. He landed on the sidewalk, then rolled over. Both young hostages started to scream. They scrambled up and ran away. I sprinted as fast as I could across Pennsylvania Avenue.
Don't shoot! I yelled. Hold your fire!
I turned and saw Samson standing there. His service revolver was still aimed at Gary Murphy. He turned the revolver up toward the sky. He kept his eyes on me. He'd finished it for both of us. Gary lay in a crumpled heap on the sidewalk. A stream of bright red blood flowed steadily from his head and mouth. He wasn't moving. The automatic rifle was still clutched in his hand. I reached out and took the gun away first. I heard cameras clicking away behind us. I touched his shoulder. Gary? Very carefully, I turned the body over. He looked like the all-American boy again. As I looked down, Gary's eyes suddenly opened. He looked straight up at me. His lips parted slowly.
Help me,
he finally whispered in a soft, choked voice.
Help me, Dr. Cross, please help me.
I knelt down close beside him. Who are you? I asked him.
I'm Gary. Gary Murphy.
When the fateful day finally arrived, I couldn't sleep, not even a couple of hours. I couldn't play the piano out on our porch. I didn't want to see anyone or talk about what was going to happen in just a few hours. I slipped in and kissed Damon and Janny while they slept. Then I left the house around 2 in the morning. I arrived at Lorton Federal Prison around 3. The execution chamber at Lorton was a small, ordinary room with 3 windows. One window was reserved for the press. One was for official observers from the state. The 3rd window was reserved for friends and family of the prisoner. There were dark blue curtains over each of the 3 windows. At 3:30 in the morning, a prison official opened them one by one. The prisoner was finally revealed, strapped down on a hospital gurney. The gurney had a makeshift extension panel for the left arm. Jesse had been staring up at the room's ceiling, but she became alert and seemed to tense as 2 technicians walked to the gurney. One of them carried the needle on a stainless steel hospital tray.
The insertion of the catheter needle was the only physical pain involved if the execution by lethal injection was done correctly. I had been coming out to Lorton to visit both Jesse and Gary Murphy for several months. I was on leave from the D.C. police force, and although I was writing this book, I had plenty of time for visits. Gary appeared to be coming apart. It was all in his workup reports. He spent most of his days lost in his complex fantasy world. It became harder and harder to coax him back to the real one, or so it appeared, and that saved him another trial, that saved him from the possibility of death row. I was certain that he was playing games, but nobody wanted to listen. I was sure he was making up another plan. Jesse had agreed to talk to me. We had always been able to talk. She wasn't surprised the state had gotten the death penalty for her and Charles Jakeley. She was responsible for the death of the son of the Secretary of the Treasury, after all. Jesse told me that she felt remorse, and had from the very beginning. But not enough to stop me. Something must have broken inside me along the way. I'd probably do the same thing today. I'd take that kind of chance for $10 million. So would a lot of people. She told me that I shouldn't feel bad after it was over. I felt very bad. I didn't know how much I believed Jesse, but I felt bad. I didn't want to be there at Lorton, but Jesse had asked me to come. There was no one else at the window for Jesse, not a single person in the world. Jesse's mother had died not long after her arrest. 6 weeks earlier, the former Secret Service agent Charles Jakeley had been executed in front of his family. That had sealed Jesse's fate. Long plastic tubes connected the needle in Jesse's left arm to several intravenous drips. The first drip, which had already started, dispensed a harmless saline solution. At a signal from the warden, sodium thiopental would be added to the intravenous. This was a barbiturate, used as an anesthetic and to put patients gently to sleep. Then a heavy dose of Pavulon would be added. This would induce death in about 10 minutes. To speed the process, an equal dose of potassium chloride was administered. This drug relaxes the heart and stops its pumping. It would cause death in about 10 seconds. Jesse found my face in her friend's window. She gave a little wave with her fingertips. I wanted to leave so badly, but I stayed. I had promised Jesse I would stay. I always kept my promises. In reality, it was nothing very graphic. Jesse finally closed her eyes. I wondered if any of the lethal drugs had been administered, but I had no way of knowing that. She took a deep breath, and then I saw her tongue drop back in her mouth. That was all there was to the modern execution of a human being. That was the end of the life of Jesse Flanagan. I left the prison and hurried to my car. When I got to my car, an ordinary white envelope was stuck under the driver's side wiper. I stuffed it in my coat pocket and didn't bother to open it until I was on my way back to Washington. I thought I knew what it was, and I was right. The thing had sent me a message, up close and personal, in my face.
Alex? Did she sob? And whine, and beg for forgiveness, before they pricked her. Did she shed a tear? Remember me to the family. I want to be remembered. Always. Son of El.
He was still playing his terrible mind games. He always would be. I'd written a diagnostic profile for the journals. Gary Sinichi/Murphy was responsible for his acts. I felt that he ought to be tried for the murders he'd committed in Southeast. The families of his black victims ought to have justice and retribution, too. If anyone deserved to be on death row, it was Sinichi/Murphy. The note told me that he'd found a way to con one of the guards. He'd gotten to somebody inside Lorton. He had another plan.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Along Came a Spider, written by James Patterson and read by Michael Kumsty and Alton Fitzgerald White. Executive producer Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Kevin Thompson. Text abridged by Kim Grunenfelder. Text edited by William Whittington. Production coordinated by Dennis Kale. Along Came a Spider is also available from Warner Books.